So this morning I'm going to introduce the sutta and just remind us about what mindfulness is, because we hear it so much that I kind of forget, I think. And then get us going on the practice that we'll do in the shrine room. This might be a little bit longer than most morning sessions just because we're trying to get oriented to the whole thing. So if it's a little bit longer, don't worry, we're not going to spend loads of time in this kind of talky format on this retreat, yeah? So we'll just get everything set up today. So the Anapanasati Sutta that we'll be using means mindfulness while breathing in and out. And everyone here has been introduced to the mindfulness of breathing, the four-stage practice. And we can think of what we're doing on this retreat with this practice as expanding from that base of that practice. So you don't need to throw that out at all. You know, it's just going to help you take that relationship with the breath you've got for this lifetime that you can remember anyway. Maybe some of you remember the breath from a previous lifetime. But just work with that a little bit more in different ways maybe that are helpful. The Thai teacher, Buddhadasa Bhikkhu, who wrote that book, Mindfulness with Breathing, says that actually the meaning of Anapanasati is quite broad. To recall anything with sati, or mindfulness, while breathing in and breathing out. So to recall anything, to be aware of anything as we're breathing in and out. And for this life, we're breathing in and out all the time, right? And then one day, that'll be it. There'll be one out breath, and we'll see what happens after that. So the sutta, the Anapanasati Sutta, is a record of the teaching on the mindfulness of breathing, mindfulness while breathing in and out, on a certain occasion. It seems as if he'd already taught this practice before this occasion, because in the way the sutta is set up, some people are already doing the practice. He's with what we can estimate to be about 400 of his disciples on a rainy season retreat for 3 months. Yeah, so that might make this retreat seem quite small, actually. It's with 400 people. And it's really quite moving. We'll hear the whole setup tonight in the shrine room, but they've been meditating for 3 months, and he's so moved by the sincerity of their practice. He tells them how sincere their practice is and how stunning that is, really, that he just decides to stay an extra month. It's worth it to stay with these people an extra month and give them more teachings. And more people come because he's staying this extra month, and they come from all around the country for this extra month of teaching. And on that extra month of teaching, he decides to give them this teaching on working with the breath. And at this point, we can imagine there's about 1,000 people have come to hear this fourth month teaching. So that's the context. The other thing that's really lovely about it is that, you know, he's teaching this particular sutta at night. Sometimes he would teach at night if the moon was bright enough. So they're all under the moonlight, 1,000 people just getting this instruction. Really beautiful scene, yeah? And often in Buddhism, there's this evocation that we're under the same moon. It's like that teaching is that close to us, that just like we're under the moon now, not that far away. These teachings were given under a moon 2,500 years ago, not that far away. There's trees that are older than that. So in a way, we can find the closeness of this teaching. So that's why we've got Shakyamuni quite prominent as an element of the retreat. Just not to forget, these are words of an enlightened being just trying to convey to people. It's very direct teaching, trying to convey to them how they can liberate their mind and get access to that state that he's been able to find access to. And he's just trying to say it quite directly to them in what boils down to 16 instructions from the Buddha. And what amazes me is that when I practice this, is that we can practice it just as if we were right there with them, receiving that instruction. I had a little glimpse of this. There's a cultural evening and someone was playing a piece. I forget who it was. It might have been Schubert. I can't remember. And someone was flipping the sheet music for him. So he was using the sheet music a little bit. And I thought, that's amazing. He's creating this whole world. He's accessing this world of experience, which is not maybe the exact same experience as the composer had, but the composer was alluding to some realm of experience. And then hundreds of years later, through these notes, he's entering into that experience. Yeah, through the sheet music. So in a way, I think it's kind of similar. We've got these 16 instructions, and it's not just these dry dots on a paper. It's actually what it's trying to point us to. Okay, so the thing he says before he gives the instruction is, mindfulness of in and out breathing, when developed and pursued, is of great fruit, of great benefit. Mindfulness of in and out breathing, when developed and pursued, brings the four foundations of mindfulness to perfection. The four foundations of mindfulness, when developed and pursued, bring the seven factors of awakening to their culmination. The seven factors of awakening, when developed and pursued, perfect clear insight and liberation. So all that means is practicing these 16 steps gets this whole thing rolling. I had quite a strong feeling with us here particularly. People have already been practicing. There's already something rolling in all of you. There's already quite strong momentum in your practice of the Dharma. And these 16 contemplations just join that. There's some momentum here, quite strong, I think, rolling towards liberation or open-heartedness or whatever you would call it. I mean, traditionally enlightenment, right? But whatever, however we relate to that. So basically, this means that practicing Anapanasati is a means to complete enlightenment. And as such, it's both a calming or samatha practice and what could be called an insight or vipassana bhavana practice, yeah, that help us to develop wisdom. Okay, so the heart of the sutta contains the actual step-by-step instructions. So sort of beforehand, we have the whole scene that I've been describing, and then we get down to the pith teaching in the middle. And the 16 contemplations are a structure for Dharma Vichaya, which is one of these seven factors of awakening. We know that there's the possibility of doing some investigative work in meditation or vipassana bhavana work, but sometimes it's not that clear how to do it, you know, so we go trying to investigate our experience, the nature of reality, and we can feel a bit lost in what we're doing. I think sometimes it can feel like I'm not quite sure how to approach this. So the 16 steps just give us things we can actually do, quite specific instructions, so then we can relax about what we should be doing or could be doing and just kind of enjoy what we're learning from it. So they're practical, actionable meditation instructions very directly, which is kind of unusual in the Pali Canon. Even the original record of the Buddha's life, we get a lot more about the story. We don't get that many places where it's just like a direct set of instructions for meditation that you could just do. But in this sutta, we have that. And they're also a description of a process by which the awareness of the breath sets in motion this kind of unfolding, moving towards liberation, clarity, kindness, those kinds of ways of being. The instructions are organized by the four foundations of mindfulness, or satipatthanas, which are the body, sometimes translated as kaya, sometimes as rupa, feelings, vedana, mind, chitta, and this fourth category, dhammas, which is mostly translated as mental objects, but I've always found that really unsatisfactory, and in Anālya's new book he goes into that, actually. It's a little bit more like mental objects, meaning ways you can look at your experience to investigate the nature of reality. Yeah. So it's like the nature of reality behind, or that's actually happening all the time, as everything we experience is going on. And these four foundations are emphasized because they're always there. They're just one way, it's not the only absolute category, a way that we could kind of look at our experience so that we could get a little bit more of a handle on it. But they're just happening all the time. We could say they make up our experience. You know, as such, for those of you that know a lot about different Buddhist categories, and like the five skandhas, it's just like another scheme like that, really. And there's ways that they map onto each other. So they're happening all the time. It's our lack of understanding of this experience that leads to our suffering, our reactive suffering. Chogyam Trungpa used to say we're a nuisance in the world. Sounds a little bit less dire, but yeah, we're not wise in them. We haven't gotten friendly enough with that experience to really understand what's going on for us and to be wise with it and kind with it. So because they're right there, they're emphasized very much in Buddhism, and it's a rich field to work with them. Yeah, through working with them that we can undo all those tight knots of confusion and contraction and just feeling that dissatisfactoriness, dukkha. So for each of the four foundations, there are four instructions. Yeah, so four on the body, four on feeling, four on the mind, and four on how to investigate the deeper nature of reality. So that gives us 16. And there's one very technical term. Each group of four is a tetrad. So I'll use that word. It's not a very poetic word, but it's a tetrad. Body tetrad, feeling tetrad, and so on. Of all the 16 instructions, only the first two are exclusively on the breath. And then the rest, then we start to open out into our broader experience. But the breath is always there. It's not like we're going to stop breathing to do the other 14 contemplations. You wouldn't get very far. So it's just there as a help to anchor us. And to the degree we've used the mindfulness of breathing as samatha practice, I think we have that experience of the breath just being there as an aid to being present when we can remember. So just a general note about each of these 16 contemplations. The word contemplation, just to understand that a little more, I'm going to use a lot of Pali words, just because I think it helps to get back to the original word. And I'm not a Pali scholar, so you're going to get not only an American accent, but a New Jersey American accent on all this Pali, right? So if you're concerned about that, you probably should go see someone who can tell you how to actually pronounce it correctly. That's my caveat. Don't know. So contemplation is anupassana, which is the Pali, and it means looking at, viewing, contemplating, consideration, or realization. So I think the important thing here is it's not pondering in this kind of very heady way that's cut off from your experience. Yeah, it's actually experiencing. The contemplating that comes from experiencing. It's not intellectually theorizing about things in lieu of experiencing what's happening now. Yeah. So it doesn't happen outside of what's actually happening right now. So it's not like, wow, if I could just get rid of these thoughts, then I could do this practice. And in a way, it's very important. I'll say a little bit more about the attitude towards practice. But it is what's happening now. It's not what I think should be happening so that I could be doing this right. Very important. And the contemplations are a way of learning from our experience. And an honest, which probably means fearless, non-acquisitive motivation to just learn is the key to practicing a sutta. So you don't need to leave with a notebook sheet of the things you've realized. Suzuki Roshi had a great, from Zen Center in San Francisco, had a great teaching. You know, beginner's mind. He said, in the expert's mind, there are few possibilities. And in the beginner's mind, there are many. I hate to tell you, I think we're all pretty deluded right now. Considering that, if we want to learn something new, we've got to let go of all those deluded frameworks. Sometimes I translate contemplations more as instructions. I like that a little bit more because it connects me back to the Buddha, just sort of saying, try this, you know, try this, it might help. And they're all very process-oriented. They're not goal-oriented. It's really interesting. If you look at the language, Thich Nhat Hanh points out that nowhere does it talk in terms of getting into any particular state, like now entering into this dhyana. It doesn't say that at all. At the same time, the things we give attention to help us stabilize the mind so that we can look at our experience a bit more. But there's no goal of saying, well, not until you're in this particular state can you do anything. It's very process-oriented. And that process is how to come into more and more directly what's happening. So if you study the Satipatthana Sutta, there's total consistency between these. They're not at odds, but the Anapanasati is a way to practice the Satipatthana teaching, which is quite broad. It's not necessarily given as one set of meditation instructions. And there's many ways you can practice with Satipatthana, so this is just one of them. But I find its specificity very elegant and doable. So we will work through the 16 contemplations over the course of the retreat. And if you read them at face value, they may not seem that exciting, or they might seem a little bit opaque, like they're there and it's kind of hard to see, well, what's through them? But we'll explore and then unpack each one. We'll go into each one together, and so hopefully something of what the Buddha was trying to point to will start to come alive for us. And each contemplation, it's just really bottomless, you know, in terms of how far it goes. So it's not like you'll do the first one on this retreat, then that'll be it for one, and you'll never do one again. Figured out one. We can just keep learning and learn from it. And that's something I've been in awe of, actually, I think, because in all my long solitaries for the past several years, I've been using this as the main framework. Also, just with other people, I think that's one of the things I was saying about this, doing our meditation review process in a group. I mean, just what other people are touching into. Sometimes that's just been like this whole new world of the nature of being human just opens up from what someone else is discovering. So they're just really limitless. The succession of instructions do describe a sequence of cause and effect. There's a pattern of conditionality in there. You know, a certain strand, kind of a nirvanic pattern. Yeah, a liberative pattern. And so practicing each paves the way for the next. It almost kind of just grows out of. It's like branches kind of growing out of each other. And then you get the beauty of the whole tree. So they show a path by which wisdom will arise. And while the instructions are quite specific, it's more like as a whole it shows a pattern. So it may not happen in a way it's organic. So we could not have these instructions. And if we really just came on to what was happening, we'd have something like the Sutta. Just kind of a description of what would happen if we just really came into awareness of the breath and what was happening with our body, with feelings, with the mind, the whole of our experience. In practicing it, we don't need to perfect one instruction before moving on to the next. And in a way, each of you would probably go at a certain pace with it, right? So we've got a bunch of us, and we each need to find our own pace in a sense, but I'm just going to give the teachings so that you have them. You can imagine the Buddha just gave it all in one night, and then people have the rest of their lives to kind of work it out. So we'll talk a little bit midway about how to work at your own pace. If it's starting to feel like, okay, you've had enough, you want to go deeper with what you've got already. You know, so we'll talk about that. But over the course of the retreat, we'll do all 16, and then there'll be chances to practice kind of at your own pace that are unled and work more with what you feel like there's benefit with. Over the years, like on one retreat, I'll work up to all 16, and then the next solitaire, I'll kind of start right with one again, and it kind of forms another pattern. And the more familiar I get with it, the more in my daily practice it's easy to do. As a whole, the whole thing deepens. But in a way, we might just see what we get from the 16 now, and in a few years, might be something different. We also don't need to practice all 16 like that in a way that's a principle of having the breath there, becoming present, and then just opening up to what's happening. We won't always be going one by one. And there's what's called a condensed method that we'll introduce at some point, which is a simplification of the 16 or the general principle behind them. I think a retreat setting is a good opportunity to practice all of them. It's probably the best way to get the chance to look at them more systematically. And then in a daily life practice where maybe something simpler might be more beneficial, at least it can be informed by the opportunity to maybe go into each a little bit more. And then there are plenty of ways to practice Anapanasati. There are just so many commentaries on working with the breath and awareness in the Buddhist canon. And there are different approaches we could take. The two main books I've used are the practice commentaries by Larry Rosenberg and Buddhadasa Bhikkhu that we've already mentioned. And also I found the new book by Analia on Satipatthana very helpful, actually. It's a good reference. It's not really so poetic, but it's a good reference. If you're going to go back and do some exploration, I'd recommend starting with Rosenberg just because I think he really gets the spirit of the practice. So great for skillful effort. So many of us, maybe the longer we've been meditating, the more we need to really work on undoing bad habits there, you know, of making an enemy of our mind and our experience. He's just so good at making friends with your experience and working from there. Buddhadasa, it's more in the Theravada tradition where there's a little bit more of a disciplined way of working, which has a lot of benefit in it, but I would really recommend that you get grounded in a friendly attitude, because if you have any bad habits that way, you might just reinforce controlling your experience so you don't actually experience everything, because some things you find difficult, which isn't, I'd say, the skillful way to understand what he's teaching, but it just kind of latches onto our habits that way. So I'd recommend starting with Rosenberg, and then Buddhadasa is a good technical reference. And while the suttas from the Pali Canon, the Theravadin tradition, we can bring an Ekayana approach, an approach informed by the Mahayana spirit and informed by the Vajrayana spirit, which is very much how I practice. Those of you that really love the Theravadin purity, you'll have to just bear with the Mahayana and Vajrayana that's going to come in. It's going to leak in. So all these different approaches are just skillful means. They're just upaya to try to get at what's underneath all that packaging. And what's great about the FWBO is fantastic. We have that broad approach. It's one of our great opportunities, I think, in this tradition. I mean, all these different approaches, I think you'd explore them over years. I mean, you don't need to get them all here. So I'll try to give you a sense of the breadth with a D, the broad way in which we can work with the sutta a little bit. Yeah, but I'm not going to try to do it all, really. Okay, so we'll work through the 16 contemplations gradually in the periods of formal meditation through sitting, walking, even lying down. We'll experiment with the different postures of mindfulness. But mindfulness can be practiced throughout our day. On my recent solitaire, I just had an emphasis of keeping a flow of awareness. That was actually probably the main practice. And just doing one thing at a time to help that. One thing I encourage you to do is just a spirit of continual practice here, trying to do just one thing at a time, and there's basically nothing we can't be aware of. And if that seems a bit strenuous, just remember there's not something we're trying to fabricate. It's not like we're trying to do our life and then build something on top of it. We're just being aware to what's actually happening. In a way, just being a bit more alive as we do whatever it is we're doing. So during meals, we can just be mindful of the texture of the food, the taste of the food, temperature of the food, that kind of thing. Be mindful of people that prepared it for us, where the food came from, someone we don't even know. Package that food, or the sun, who gave it light, and the rain watered it, or whatever. You know, who knows what. Maybe the water came from a sprinkler. Maybe we noticed disliking the idea that the water came from a sprinkler, not from the natural rain, whatever it is. We just notice eating. And when we're doing work periods, that's part of the retreat too. So it's not like we have to do a job and do it quickly and hastily and what a bother so I can get back to the retreat. So when you're slicing a carrot, noticing the weight of the carrot, noticing the texture of the skin, noticing the sharp knife, noticing the pleasure of a sharp knife slicing. The dull knife, noticing the dukkha of a dull knife. So whatever we're doing, the Buddha often exhorted his disciples to include all their activities and their practice of mindfulness. And I always love how he includes defecating and urinating. Because if we have any idea of something being spiritual and other things being not spiritual, that kind of breaks that, doesn't it? It's not that there's spiritual things we need to be aware of. It's really just anything we can be aware of. In the Thai forest tradition, when they're teaching people, they talk about, oh, so did you wake up on an in-breath or an out-breath? And so just being mindful of the possibility of doing this in a skillful way that isn't forced or strained or willful. So if you feel like you're getting kind of tight and willful, then just relax and just throw it all out the window and just maybe go for a walk or something. Just try to loosen up a bit and then just try to enter into relationship with yourself again. Don't just keep hammering away in this tight, painful way. So you're just doing your best. And it might really be a very skillful thing just to let go of any idea of trying to do anything for a while, you know, just to relax. So the practice starts with having gone to the forest, to the shade of a tree, or to an empty building. So it's purposely going somewhere to practice, yeah? So I guess other than those of you that happen to live here, a lot of you had to quite purposefully come here. You've intentionally come. And so just remembering that we're kind of here by choice and yeah, that we're practicing. And then it says setting mindfulness to the fore. So I'll just say a few words about mindfulness. So it's sati. Mindfulness is sati. That's the main aspect we'll be emphasizing. There's some other aspects which I'll talk about later on in the retreat, but this is where we're entering in. And this is a present moment awareness that simply notices what's happening without in any way interfering or adding or subtracting or correcting, controlling. So just letting what's happening come into awareness. And things will change of their own accord. We don't need to actually orchestrate all that. So maybe it's helpful to think, well, what's mindfulness by knowing what it's not? So when we're not mindful, we're lost in everything. It's just happening kind of to us and we're lost in it. We're not really aware of what's happening. So things are happening, we're just aware. This is what's happening. With a broader awareness. So anything can happen within this held in awareness, you could say, held very loosely in awareness. And awareness is just part of our experience. It's actually natural to us. It's not something we have to fabricate. It's more that we've got so many habits that are warding it off. We're not quite prepared to be aware and all that entails. We do all sorts of things to distract us from what's happening. So it's more like letting go. We don't have to do all those things. We could be a little less anxious and busily covering everything up and just let those things become known to us. So in a way, it's very restful just to let that happen. Let what's happening be what's happening. And the Buddha often spoke about relaxing the exhaustion of running around, running away from what's happening. Okay, so sometimes it says mindfulness is like a mirror in that it just simply reflects what's happening. And the only thing I'd say about that is that could be a little bit of a cold image. So I think if we add to that it's also kind, yeah? And it's emotionally engaged. So I think its other key quality is metta, or kindness. It's what's happening, and there's this kind of a basic friendliness to what's happening. It doesn't mean we don't have a sense of things that might be more or less helpful to us in the content, you know. So some things we might just sort of try to relax and not fuel so much, and that will come in later. So it's not like it's completely non-discriminating in a way. But the basic attitude towards everything is that we're willing to experience it. we're willing to experience anything. When people speak of feeling alienated, that's a clue that we're holding back from some aspect of our experience. So there's a tension, some trace of tension in there, yeah? So we can create a kind of false peace by blocking off a bit of it. I had an experience with this in our cultural evening on the chairs meeting. There was a certain piece of music which involved three people, two of which were sounding rather pleasant to me, and one of which was sounding like nails on a chalkboard. It was awful. The third instrument, I won't say what it was. But I did realize, wow, I can listen to two-thirds of this. Like, I'm capable of actually completely blocking off that third and only listening to two-thirds of this piece of music and enjoying it, you know? So we can do that. We can sort of block off things. And I think the danger is not even knowing we're doing it. Actually, you know, tensions do that. So it's very important to be willing to experience. And I think that's one of the efficacies. The great things about the Anapanasati is that by being based in the breath, in a way it keeps us honest to some degree because we're grounded in the body and an actual experience. So somewhere at least, there's something quite direct happening. So I'll just say a couple more things. Just emphasizing that this non-judgmental attitude is just very, very important in meditation. And in a way, we can take an opportunity to just purify our practice of craving, the craving that we bring to the practice itself, that can just make meditation another source of suffering, a way in which we strengthen our habit for suffering. So just let yourself have a break from that the best you can. And if you just notice how hard that is, then just be kind towards that. And in a way, you might be used to a manner of meditating in which we're a little bit more directive and controlling about our experience. If something comes up that's classified as unskillful, then we jump in there and we substitute the wholesome for the unwholesome. And actually, there's value to that. But I think one thing we have to be careful about in this, I think we come in this culture with a lot of background conditioning that has some dangers to that. So where we're going to practice here is we're not going to be doing this substituting thing. We're not going to be intervening in that way. The main way we're going to work with our experience is to be willing to experience the main thing. So if you're meditating and what you call a hindrance arises or a distraction arises, we're going to do the simplest thing, which is just notice that's happening and to acknowledge it's happening and kindly find the breath again. Sometimes we talk about this in terms of working with a sky-like mind kind of attitude where we don't create more solidity by getting horrified by what's happening and reacting to it. So whatever's happening, it's like clouds moving through the sky. Everything changes. It will change, actually. We can't stop it from changing. It is changing. And just try to have a sense of a broader mind in which things can come and go. So by doing that, I think we'll have an experience of that broader mind and increasingly be able to trust that. So first we might just experiment with that on faith. So we're going to get started on the body tetrad. Just because we're focusing on the body won't mean that other aspects of our experience aren't happening. So, you know, feelings will be happening and the mind will be doing its thing. It's not that we're going to try to cut out this other experience. It's just that in the whole stream of our experience, as it's flowing, we're going to pay attention to a particular strand of it that's related to all the rest, and it's the breath. So we're just going to come in on the breath.